This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Democrat Spencer Merriweather became Mecklenburg County District Attorney on the recommendation of his predecessor, Andrew Murray, a Republican who left the office to become U.S. Attorney for Western North Carolina. Merriweather is now running for election to a full term in the office and is being challenged in the primary by fellow Democrat and former public defender Toussaint Romaine. Merriweather says the criminal justice system is under a microscope and that skepticism is good. He says he's been taking a fresh look at things. Romaine, who came to prominence by placing himself between police and demonstrators during the Keith Scott protests, wants to hold the system accountable. Both are in our Spirit Square studio this hour for a conversation about how each sees the job of district attorney and how they believe the office should be run. You can join our conversation. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter @charlottetalks. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. Mr. Merriweather, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Mr. Romaine, thanks. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Good to see you. Let me ask you both variations of the same question to start. Spencer, had it not been for the fact that you were recommended for this job by your predecessor, would you be running for this job in this election, and why do you want it in the first place?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me today, and also happy 20th anniversary, belatedly.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
In fact, this is a job that I sought, and I sought it because I wanted it. I sought it because I thought that I can make a critical difference. I thought that, and still think that, my experience gives me an opportunity to make some critical changes, to establish trust in the system, to give communities a voice, and to go about the work of eliminating bias. I think through the window that I've had into the criminal justice system and the ability to stand up for victims, there's a lot that we depend on in our court system. It gives people a voice, empowers people, protects people, and has the capacity to restore them. But there's some critical changes that need to be made, and I think it takes someone with experience to make those changes.
Toussaint Romaine, same question with a little flip. You came from the public defender's office. Why switch sides, essentially, and why do you want the job?
Yeah, great question, Mike. And the answer is there's one system that we all work in. And I've been with federal prosecutors, I've worked for judges, I've worked for and done ride-alongs with the police, even worked inside of the jails, doing interviews for folks who had just newly been arrested and figuring out what their drug issues were, so that we could implement programs in those communities. So I've been in a position where I've had a chance to see all sides, and now as a professor of criminal justice and teaching this stuff, and teaching courts and teaching mass incarceration and constitutional law, Mike, what I've seen is that it's a system that needs overhauling. And that's why I'm running, is to really address the system issue. Not just one-sided and having one-sided experience, but having experience from all over and then realizing that, you know, we all want to get better. Everyone wants to get better. We all want public safety to be our goal. But ultimately, this system should be one of justice. And I want to make sure that justice is put back into our system so that we can have a criminal justice system, mm-hmm. and not just a system that's criminal.
You spent 11 years, Spencer, as an assistant DA. What have you learned in the time that you've been the district attorney that you didn't know before, either about the job itself or about the office?
What you learn in the way that you engage with the community is in a different way. Much of the work that I have done has been with individual organizations. It's been with individual victims of crime. And you realize that there are system effects across the board where you can make a definite impact. And quite frankly, you can make it by applying your will to a particular circumstance. I think that's critical. I think that it's up to the district attorney to provide leadership and direction to the office, but also, and this is really important, to have the trust of courthouse partners and the trust of the community to collaborate with them and make these changes. No matter what happens, it can't just be the district attorney alone. It's got to be.
And when you say collaborate, are you talking about collaborating with the public defender's office as well?
Indeed.
Okay. And do you think there's collaboration? But has there been collaboration between the public defender's office and the district attorney's office?
I will say this, and I'll compliment Mr. Merriweather in this sense. He, in the past 4 months or 5 months since he's been appointed, he's had some outreach to the public defender's office and has reached out to others within our criminal justice department. But I think for the most part, the administration now and I think even prior has still remained in a silo to where they've pretty much have operated within themselves. And so I think the beginning outreach that Mr. Merriweather is having is to create that. But I think we need to go even further. And I believe the opportunities exist. And I would hope, if I'm in this role, then I would definitely do that. And I would hope and believe that Mr. Merriweather would as well. But there is a need to have stronger and deeper roots because our community is in need of it. And I've been doing that for the past 22 years since I've been here in Charlotte, building those relationships. But I think Mr. Merriweather is right. It needs to happen, and we need someone in that role who can do it.
A lot of people in the community, particularly in the African-American and other minority communities, are hurting for many reasons. Among them, the way they are handled in the criminal justice system and the lack of confidence, faith, and or trust, if you want to, whichever word you want to use, that they have in that system. At this moment in our history, every single position of significance in the city of Charlotte is held by an African American. And no matter which one of you wins this race for district attorney, the office will be held by an African American. How much, if any, and I want to hear from both of you, how much, if any, of significance should we attach to that? I'll start with you, Tucson.
I'll be a little controversial with this response.
Okay.
Just having a person of color in a leadership role doesn't mean change will happen. And I think what's necessary is not just to have someone of color in that role, but to have someone who will make the changes that the community needs in that role, no matter what color you are. And I think Mr. Merriweather has said before, and I agree with him, it's remarkable to have two African-American males running for the head prosecutor role in Mecklenburg County, and that's a good thing. But we need to have individuals who are willing to make the implementation and application of the changes that need to happen, because otherwise it's for naught. You could just have a figurehead. That figurehead doesn't do the work that the community needs. And what's the point?
Spencer.
I think it is strikingly remarkable that you have as many African-Americans in these positions of leadership in Mecklenburg County. And to a person, every single person holding a position before they got that head job, as Mr. Romaine says, put together an entire career of experience in that field. When you look at our chief of police, when you look at our mayor who put together many years of work in the city administration, when you think about our fire chief, when you think about our city manager who has a whole host of experience in the area of city administration, those are models for me. And it's exactly why I take my experience and my perspective into this work and want to stay here.
It's hard for Republicans to win a countywide race in Mecklenburg County, which I suppose explains why there are only Democrats running for this office. But I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Toussaint Romain, you were a Republican and you declared yourself as a Democrat for this race. It was strictly till you could be competitive, or did you actually change your affiliation for other reasons?
Well, here's the truth, and we've had this discussion before.
Okay.
I'm about system reform. My godfather was Julian Bond. My godfather is Mayor David Dinkins of New York City. Julian Bond, who marched with Dr. King, was my mentor. I lived with Rosa Parks for a week. Mm-hmm. Had dinner with Barack Obama, Senator Obama back then, and worked with Senator John Edwards. What I learned from these individuals is that they can change the system if they implement things to make it better. And at the end of the day, the poor and the vulnerable and the most vulnerable in our community is who I'm concerned about. And so if we can get the right wing and the left wing to flap together, mm-hmm. then that means this bird can start to fly. And what I mean by that is back in 2010, the Republicans didn't care about black people. Yeah. I made this quite clear. When I was had an opportunity to speak to Republicans, they said, well, help us make this system better. So I did. Mm-hmm. And I had to join them to help make it better, to get on the inside, to really help that wing fly and flap as well as the other wing so that our community, those who are most vulnerable and those who are struggling the most, to get the benefit mm-hmm. of political leaders working for their advantage, the advantage of the people. And that's the same reason why I'm running to be the next district attorney. Is because we have a system that's broken. And I'm not afraid to go in any system or in any side that needs to be fixed, because we need to make sure it's better for the people that are in the system or that are having experienced this system. And that's why I'm running. I changed party back in 2017, I believe, in January, because Jeff Sessions just wasn't, he was creating policies and things that had impact on the local community as far as undoing police accountability projects, dismantling the civil rights programs and other things like that. I'm no fan of Trump. I've made that clear since day one. I'm not a fan of politics. I've made that clear since day one. And I was able to be in the rooms to challenge those folks who had comments about President Barack Obama and other things that were happening. And having and being in the room and having a chance to challenge that was good. And that's been good here in Mecklenburg County, which, again, is my community. I'm not never been concerned about the national stage. And so that's the same reason why I'm running to be the next DA, is to get into the room and to make sure we're not just talking about things that sound good, but actually changing some policies and doing things that make us good.
So let's talk about trust and mistrust. Spencer, you say that skepticism is a good thing. People are skeptical about whether or not the system is rigged. You say that's a good thing because, I guess, it keeps you on your toes and you wanted to take a fresh look when you took the office.
Toussaint,
you want to reform the criminal justice system. You've spoken about that a lot so far this morning. How much of the reform, and I'll start with you, Spencer Merriweather, how much of the reform should focus on police versus the district attorney's office and the court system?
Well, I think that all of us are open to skepticism, and we should invite skepticism. To the extent that in my role as district attorney, that I have a relationship with the police department, they don't work for me and I don't work for them. What is true is that we are the Constitution of North Carolina, and there's a public expectation that we work as partners to, you know, uphold justice and safety, and that does take trust. When, you know, there is justified skepticism of the police department, it affects my function as district attorney. When there are people who are distrustful and mistrustful of the work that I do for good reason, it affects officers on the street and it affects the community through and through. Mm-hmm. So all of us must find ways to go about our work in ways that build trust. It's the reason why I believe that it's important for us to open up our offices to those who ask questions and those who want to challenge us on specific issues. I think that sunshine is, in fact, a disinfectant, and I think it'll make us better in the long run.
You want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. My approach would be a little different. The police and their leadership have mentioned that they have officers that they want to get rid of, but they can't because of the way the system is designed. And there are officers who commit crimes, officers who are doing things that jeopardize the lives of other officers. And I think I've mentioned before, 80% of all complaints against the police are filed by other police, and that involves a list of issues of violating policy, rules, constitutional rights of individuals, and crime. The situation that the DA's office must be in is to be the one to hold officers accountable for breaking those rules, for doing things that jeopardize safety in our community. And what we've seen is that because of the close relationship and because of this institutionalized partnership, DAs typically across the nation as well as here in Mecklenburg County have been unwilling to hold officers accountable. 17 police shootings in the past year and a half, and not one officer by this office was held accountable, despite there being evidence to support such. And so this office, there's an old KRS-One phrase that police were put here to protect us, but who protects us from the police? Mm. And the answer is the district attorney's office, if they're going and willing to do so. And so I believe the relationship between the two is as Mr. Merriweather suggested, but there has to be some another level added there to where the DA's office must be willing to step back and hold police accountable, just like they hold others accountable for committing crime.
That's former public defender Toussaint Romain, who is running to be the next district attorney of Mecklenburg County against the incumbent, Spencer Merriweather. Both are Democrats. Both are here in our studio for the remainder of the hour. We'll come back. We'll talk about their various ideas on how this office ought to be run and the problems facing people who interface with the criminal justice system in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. You listen to the show, so you know that 287G is a big issue in the race for sheriff. This week on the FAQ City podcast, host Nick Della Canal answers your questions about the controversial program and what your vote means in the May primary. Find the latest episode of FAQ City on iTunes, NPR One, and on WFAE.org/FAQ City, where you can pose your question to the FAQ City podcast.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. So we're here with our two candidates for Mecklenburg County District Attorney, Spencer Merriweather and Toussaint Romain. They're both running in the primary, although there will be no Republican running against them in the general election. So who wins the primary that's aside the race, another reason to vote in the primary, I suppose. You set out, Spencer Merriweather, to take a fresh look at the DA's office when you were appointed by the governor to fill out the remaining term of your predecessor, who left to be the U.S. Attorney for the district of Western District of North Carolina. What has been the result of this fresh look?
The result of that fresh look has already resulted in the creation of two new prosecution teams in our office to address violent crime. It's resulted in your district attorney championing for a family justice center that better serves victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse. And we're having great progress that's well underway as far as the planning for that justice center. We have already lifted financial constraints for first-time offenders who are trying to keep their record clean. That's been something that's critical, which represents a value of financial equity that we're trying to inject into the court system. We are not done with that yet, but we are off to a great start. We have, articulated the ways in which we hope to, eliminate bias in our justice system, both in trial practices as well as in office-wide practices as well. We've gone about great work through the Safety and Justice Challenge, which I believe you did a show on. And there'll be some announcements in the coming months about some things that we're doing to make our existing bail system more fair. Quite frankly, there's a whole lot more we need to do. But until we're able to do the heavy haul of a constitutional amendment to eliminate monetary bail altogether, mm-hmm. I think there are some great changes that I've been able to make along with other courthouse partners to make a difference and to make this thing more fair.
And you've talked about making the system more fair, Toussaint Romain. You say that not everyone needs to be sent to prison forever. Is that the fault of the DA's office, or is that the fault of judges, or the fault of laws that mandate certain sentences that judges have no control over, which come from the legislature?
Well, I'm going to stick just with the district attorney's office, okay. And that's the role that I'm seeking. And the reality is that if everyone is prosecuted because it's a tough-on-crime approach, then judges really have very limited options because of structured sentencing. So if a case comes before the judge and it's prosecuted in this sense, because the DAs have decided to do so, then every case will have to go in front of a judge. And I would say, and not to be debatable here, but with Mr. Merriweather's current office, it's the same leadership as Andrew Murray. It's many of the same policies. This justice center that he's speaking about, well, there are already programs that exist in the community that are already doing great work. A justice center that's just Justice Department run, those haven't been effective. They're relics of the 1980s, and they're not effective. The financial restraints that Mr. Merriweather also speaks about is only about one program that the Public Defender's Office challenged the DA's office about, saying you're charging this individual for money to get into this deferral program. That one type of program is what Mr. Merriweather is talking about having changed. But that was just on the heels of before a judge was able to decide it. There are still a dozen other financial programs that can be addressed and must be addressed as it relates to charging individuals money for deferral programs, right? 90% of everyone in our system is indigent, meaning they can't afford to pay for anything, bail, court costs and fines, or deferral programs. And if we're not willing to make the immediate changes that need to be made, they can still go through these programs. There are resources out there that exist and programs that exist that don't have a cost to them. If we could defer and divert those people into those programs to get the help they need and it doesn't cost money, our system is safer as a result, and that's necessary and must happen. And with regard to not everyone needs to go to prison, not everyone does go to prison, but everyone that gets charged with something and is prosecuted gets a conviction. And that conviction builds up and leads to more people getting more convictions and eventually then getting prison time. We're in a position right now to where we can have programs that divert folks from getting convictions. And I think that's important because once you get a conviction, you can't get housing many ways. You can't get a job. And for some cases, some charges, some situations, you can't get financial aid to go to college. So we got to change that system because we can, because there are folks who can do things if they had an opportunity, a second chance, before a conviction, to get back on their feet and to be contributing members of society.
Mike, there's a couple things I want to respond
sure.
to.
Sure, I'm sure they are.
First of all, Mr. Romain, to his credit, joined a party and said he wanted to make change and spent 7 years in that party, and we've yet to see any particular change as a result of his desire to do so. What I've done in 5 months as far as making change is, in fact, injecting a value of giving people second chances with regard to people who have convictions. One of the things I did not mention is the great work that we've done, again, working with community organizations to try to create a permanent expungement clinic in the courthouse. And that is something that required the leadership of courthouse partners, specifically the leadership of the district attorney's office. Mm-hmm. And we've gone a long way in doing that. When I talk about a family justice center and Mr. Romaine talks about we have enough already, clearly this is somewhere he doesn't actually want to make change. And I think that in our 87 homicides that occurred last year, and knowing that a quarter of those were the result of intimate partner violence, I know that there are changes that need to be made, and we need to go about that work. We need to have the same sort of results they had in the Bronx, where they went 18 months in the Bronx in New York without an intimate partner homicide, in large part because of the presence of a multifaceted family justice center in conjunction with what's referred to as a community coordinated campaign or community coordinated response against domestic violence. These things are critical and they're important. And when I talk about financial equity in the justice system, Mr. Romaine knows that we're not just going to stop with deferred prosecution. I've already made a commitment that by the end of the summer, we're going to make sure that there are non-cost prohibitive programs available to all folks so that it doesn't matter how much money you have in your pocket in order to be able to keep your record clean, mm-hmm. but that we're going to make sure that if it's fair for you to be able to keep your record clean, we're going to make sure that that happens.
I'm going to put words.
I need to respond just real quickly to the three of those. One, the expunction clinic that Mr. Merriweather speaks of that he says he created, it already existed. So it's like the new owner of the Panthers. It's like the new owner of the Panthers coming into Charlotte saying, I'm bringing the Panthers to Charlotte. Talk to the clerk of court, Lisa Chingeri, and she'll tell you that the expunction clinic existed in the self-help center. It was there and it's been there for many years, and there have been several expunction clinics since then. I know because I helped create that clinic, writing and designing the things that were there, and have been part of these clinics since that day. So it's disingenuous, I believe, to say that the clinics were being created by this current office. I'd also suggest that I'm not saying that we don't need to change and that a justice center is not important. What I am saying is, it's not good for the DA's office to come in and say, we're creating a justice center, we're going to do these things, when those centers already and those programs already exist in our community. It would be more important for the DA's office to collaborate and to join other folks, because that's actually what happened in the Bronx. I know because I went there and had a chance to study that. They're teaming up with folks who are already in the program and already doing things. And all things considered, we don't need to wait for all these months to pass by to get promises of change. That can happen right now, and the DA's office has the ability to make those changes. And 11 years of experience, Mr. Merriweather shouldn't have to wait to do more research. He can do those things now if he was going to do it, and that's my fear, is that we're not going to actually get it done.
So I know that you take issue with much of that.
Pretty much, yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Go ahead and respond to that.
Well, quite frankly, I hope that Mr. Romaine chooses to hear what I'm saying as far as the permanent expungement clinic at the courthouse. The fact is that this is a government function, and it ought to happen in a place of government. And while I understand that Mr. Romaine has a breadth of experience, I question the depth of experience in specific areas, because he was not at the table when I was at the table with the clerk of court, with partners from the Council of Elders, to set up a permanent expungement clinic in the courthouse, which we'll be seeing the fruits of as early as next month. This is in 5 months that I've been able to make some of these changes. What you see here is a proven ability to make change, and I think that if I'm given 4 more years, I can do a whole lot more.
So that's where he decided to start. Where would you have started had you taken over 5 months ago?
Yeah, and great question. And Mr. Merrill doesn't have either the breadth or the depth in this work. He's been in this role for 4 months. For the past 11 years that he's been a prosecutor, hasn't done any of this stuff. What I would say to him is that Council of Elders in every group can show up every day and decide to do something brand new. There's 4,000 nonprofits in Mecklenburg County because someone always shows up to do something that already exists. Mm-hmm. Where I would have started is just using what already exists in our system. The clerk of court, if Mr. Merriweather was sitting with her, she would have told him, we have an expunction clinic. We have a system already set up that I was able to be a part of and help set up, where judges are signing stuff. We have lawyers, and I helped train lawyers who were able to come in and do the expunctions and get pro bono credit for it, because that was what we've designed, and it was working. Folks were getting things done. The Charlotte School of Law was a program that we were working with in great detail, and they were the students doing the work that we needed. Now that they're gone, there's a need to get more there. But where I would have started is getting into these deferral programs and returning to prosecutors in the current office the 85 prosecutors there more discretionary power to be able to look at cases and say, we're not just going to prosecute everything. I can't do that, Tucson, because my manager supervisor says no. Giving DAs the ability to do what's called step into their shoes,
right,
where they can step into the shoes of the individual that's charged and figure out why this person committed this crime.
Both of you, over the course of being on this program several times in the past and in some things you've said on the stump and some things that you've said just in other locations, what you're saying is this reform movement for criminal justice really focuses on people who are poor, indigent, and it's race-related in many cases because that's who the poor people are. But to a lot of people, your new approach, both of your approaches, may sound like you're getting soft on crime as opposed to years of getting tough on crime. And yet both of you talk about the need to keep the community safe. How do you keep communities safe if you don't take people and lock them up who have committed crimes instead of giving them second and third and fourth chances? I'll start with you, Spencer.
Crime in large part comes from desperation. Desperation in large part comes from poverty. And, you know, a lot of other types of things that afflict our population, when we talk about mental health, when we talk about addiction, when we talk about poverty, those are three things that we know can be at the source of someone's criminal behavior. If we can attack these problems at the source, we can do a whole lot towards making sure that people
divert.
What
is the source?
The source, in fact, is that addiction, and that is that mental health, and it is that poverty. When people experience things like that, they become desperate. And when they become desperate, they operate in desperate ways.
But as a district attorney or as a person who operates with the court system, you can't expunge poverty and you can't expunge the reasons for the desperation that leads to drug addiction and making bad choices and using a gun to commit a crime.
But these problems are staring me in the face every single day, and they're staring our judges in the face and they're staring our juries in the face every single day in the mm-hmm. courthouse. What you see in the courthouse is a place of great need. What I can do as district attorney and what I think our courthouse partners can do is connect people who have need with resources, both structural and financial, quite frankly.
In lieu of punishment?
Sometimes, yes. Now, there's sometimes when people stick a gun in somebody's face and you know what I got to do? I got to actually prosecute that person. And sometimes I got to send those folks to prison. And that is okay. But there are also some times when I can attack the underlying causes of crime. And I'd be crazy not to do those things and not to connect people with need with resources.
Tucson Romain.
Yeah, tough on crime is an approach that we've had since the 80s, and that's not worked. It's been the approach of the current administration and the former administration to where it's just prosecute everyone with no care or concern about what happens after the person is prosecuted. And that's what we're talking about needs to change. Soft on crime isn't the alternative for me. It's not talking about being soft on crime. And what we need to have is to be smart on how we're addressing crime. And what that looks like is by saying, all right, I disagree with Mr. Merriweather having represented individuals who've been charged with crime. It's not all desperation. It's not all addiction or mental health. They need alternatives to life. And if you live in poverty, because the issue is ultimately poverty, that's who ends up in the system. Listen, everyone has either used drugs or committed some crime. If you have money, then you can buy justice. You can buy your way out of the system. Those aren't the people that end up being convicted and prosecuted.
Is that why you believe that marijuana possession should be decriminalized?
Well, here's the issue there. And what I've seen, what we're learning across the nation right now is that if an individual is using marijuana and if they have resources, then they can pay for the programs, deferral programs, and they can get out. And there's no conviction. For those that can't afford to pay for the programs, to get deferral programs, they end up getting a conviction. And then these are the same folks that they're not able to get jobs as a result. They're not able to get housing. And in many instances, based on some level of marijuana, they're not able to get financial aid for college.
But it's a state law. So if you're caught and the police decide to charge you with possession of marijuana, what do you, as a district attorney, what leeway do you have? Because it's a state law.
Yeah,
and it's a federal law as well.
A lot of leeway. As the head prosecutor, they have complete discretion as to how they deal with any charge, any charge. What is happening in Texas with D.A. Gonzalez and what we can do here in Charlotte, and what's even happening in Buncombe County, North Carolina, is having opportunity for folks to come in if you're charged with it and it's a citation, which we would ask and help officers deal with, for just possession and use of marijuana. then let folks come in. Give them a deferral program, give them education of things, and then as a result, dismiss the charge. And every time someone comes back with that, giving them the same thing. And eventually, hopefully, they'll learn. Because I remember when I was a kid, there was this commercial where this egg was sizzling in a pot, and this is your brain on drugs, right? And
right.
I got it. I learned that, wow, I don't want to have my brain to be like that.
Right.
So what if we educated folks to help them sooner or later realize what they need to do?
So I just hope we're willing to admit that a lot of what is being described actually already happens in our court system right now. There are multiple diversion opportunities that are given to people who have small amounts of marijuana, in part because while marijuana is against the law in North Carolina, you know, prosecutors do have to make a decision about what they prioritize. I'm prioritizing people breaking into your house.
Right.
I'm prioritizing violent crime. Simple possession of marijuana, quite frankly, you know, we want to make sure we're giving people as many chances as possible.
But you said you're not inclined to offer a blanket
That's
commitment
exactly right.
to not prosecuting for possession. Why?
In part because when possession is charged, it may not just be someone holding a joint, smoking it, or taking it back to some party. It could be, in fact, that someone is selling it outside of somebody's grandma's house. And that, quite frankly, doesn't make our community safer. Now, the only charge that I may be able to proceed on is the possession, but I may know that there's more context mm-hmm. to what's actually going on there. So will I commit to a blanket commitment to not prosecute possession of marijuana? No.
How big a problem is this in Mecklenburg County?
It's a big problem. And possession alone is all I'm talking about, not the selling and delivering of drugs.
But you are against the war on drugs.
I am.
What does that mean?
I'm on the board of Inuvia, and we've mm-hmm. had a chance to see drugs
and
heroin
program.
In particular. And those who are using heroin are able to get treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Those who use marijuana, contrary to what Mr. Merriweather is suggesting, they're still prosecuted in district court and in superior court. If they don't have the money to be part of deferral programs, they're not getting the benefit of that.
But Mr. Merriweather believes, and I don't think I'm putting words in your mouth, that you do believe that using the courts as a vehicle for recovery rather than incarceration for those suffering from addiction is a good idea.
Exactly. And some of that's already happening. You know, when we talk about when Mr. Romaine talks about his membership in Inuvia, it's not just heroin. It's not just crack. It's meth, marijuana, all of it. People have access to
and
treatment.
Alcohol.
Yes.
Yeah. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Spencer Merriweather and Toussaint Romaine, both running for district attorney in Mecklenburg County. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and one of the two men we're talking to this morning will be elected to be the next district attorney for Mecklenburg County. The incumbent, Spencer Merriweather, who took over for his predecessor, Andrew Murray, who went off to become the U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, or Toussaint Romaine, a former public defender who gave up his job as a public defender to make this run for office, although you do teach, so some money is coming in. Let me share an email that Brian sent us. I have taught classes, he says, in Mecklenburg Jail since 2000 and am concerned about the frequency of serious arrests and the very short amount of time these offenders spend in jail. I just don't understand how a 17-year-old can commit a dozen felonies and have a dozen arrests in an 18-month time span. I've had 5 or 6 inmates released after taking my classes that didn't make it to the age of 19 because they were shot and killed. Is that a district attorney question? I mean, how do you explain that, Spencer Merriweather?
Well, I think when you realize you have someone who is in, who has committed these type of offenses, particularly when it's someone who is a youthful offender, 17 years old, you want to put all the resources that you can behind making sure that person doesn't return. You know, this is someone who, you know, teaches classes at the jail.
Mm-hmm.
The question would be, are there things that we can be doing both in and outside of the jail to make sure this person doesn't return to the court system? It's one of the reasons why I think that community engagement is so important. People who live in neighborhoods where offenders may come from have a vested interest in making sure people are able to make positive contributions. There's great work being done all across our community, and the idea is to connect youthful offenders with those folks doing that great work. That is probably the best way for folks not to return.
On the one hand, you don't want to ruin a kid's life who at 16 or 15 or 17 does something stupid that he may not have done at the age of 28. And if you put them behind bars and you give them a criminal record, it really does serious and perhaps unending damage to their ability to make a living going forward and get an education, et cetera, and find housing, which creates more crime. But then if you go light on these individuals, the guy who just emailed us, Brian, who sees these people coming back 10 and 12 times in an 18-month period, how do you keep neighborhoods safe? How do you, Toussaint, because you frame this as you want the grandmama living in a neighborhood feeling that she can go outside and not be shot or robbed or whatever, mugged. How do you do that?
So that grandmother is my neighbor, Grandma White, and I've talked to her a lot about this. And let's be very clear and distinguish between what kind of crimes we're talking about. Violent crime, well, that has to be something that we're not allowing on our streets. But that's not all the young
people. Doesn't one thing lead to another? If you let them off easy on stealing a candy bar and they come back and they steal a car the next time and then they need something for drugs so they stick you up at gunpoint, one thing lead to another?
No, that's the fear that many of us have in our community. If we're able to intervene and get involved early on, then we don't have to be there. If you're convicted and have a conviction on your record, there's no alternative for you but future crime. And my idea and what I'm speaking of is for those low-level misdemeanor nonviolent offenses, we can deal with them differently instead of putting them in the system, because once you're in, there's no getting out. So what idea that a policy I plan on would put in place, something I learned while I was in Chicago speaking to the DA's office there. They have something called a community prosecution program to where the police, the DA's office, and that local community get together and they identify what issues, what crimes are happening there, what help they need based on the issues that their folks are facing, and then having collaboration with organizations that are already existing to come in and to do the work there. I have these relationships. They're pre-existing. We can get in on day one and do the work. I don't need to wait for the entire summer. So there's things we can do immediately, and that's what needs to happen in our community. So that, to Brian's point, while they're in jail, they're not just getting the help they need before they get out. That needs to happen across the board.
What are your thoughts on that, Spencer?
Oh, I agreed largely in the sense that we do need to make sure that we connect youthful offenders with resources. What I will say is that it does matter when someone is breaking into your house. That's an extreme violation of someone's sense of security. And in many cases, one thing does lead to another. And we have to make sure that we're taking crime seriously and that people understand that we're taking crime seriously. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't be creative about how we address those things. The next question that someone has to ask after someone has been held accountable is, how do we make sure this person doesn't return here? That has to be a part of the prosecutor's equation in dealing with whatever crime comes across his or her desk.
We have to talk about bias, implicit and otherwise, because that seems to be rampant in our society. And if the videos that we've seen on television of officer interaction with some African-American men particularly are any indication, and if the Black Lives Matter has pointed anything out, it is that there is an unjustness going on within certain areas of the country, and maybe all over the country. You point out people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, Toussaint, and races are treated differently by the cops and by the courts. We've talked about bail and its affordability. And if you're poor and you can't afford to pay the bail, you sit in jail until the trial and you lose your job and maybe your house and maybe your spouse as that goes through. How would you reform that part of the system? How do you push out bias, and how do you make the courts and the system understand that poor people, even if they've done something wrong, can't afford the fines or the bail?
Yeah, three things I would say. One, and addressing the police issue, police officers at CMPD receive a lot of training. They receive implicit bias training, but they're not held accountable when they violate that training. That would be one difference that, as the next DA, I would implement. Holding officers accountable for violating implicit bias training. We don't do that, and we need to. Secondly, with regard to the bail and the bond issue, we can have cash-free bails and cash-free bonds, and recognizing that in our system, if you have money, you can get out. And in Charlotte-Mecklenburg County, we know our Upward Mobility Task Force report that folks, people of color, aren't getting and don't have the same resources that others have. And sadly, they're stuck in the system. And the third thing I would say is this. Larry Krasner in Philadelphia is doing something to where he is holding and auditing prosecutors who make decisions, and he's able to go through and say, here's decisions that you've made. Mm-hmm. Here's where we recognize that there has been some implicit bias interwoven in your decisions. Let's figure out how we can deal with that. Not firing you, but let's make sure you're aware of your implicit bias, and let's put practices in place to prevent implicit biased type decisions from being made in the future. And if those decisions continue to be made once awareness is there, then have to talk about other remedies that can happen. But from the DA's perspective, holding officers accountable for violating implicit bias issues, putting situations in place to DA's making decisions with cases, whether it's papering cases, whether it's bail cases, bail issues, and making sure that we're addressing implicit bias in our decisions in court. But then third, holding prosecutors accountable individually for the implicit bias that may or may not be involved in cases.
Spencer Merriweather.
In order to, you know, Mr. Romaine talks about holding people accountable, and he is bound by the same burden of proof that I am, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if I have a case where I have some evidence that allows me to demonstrate proof beyond a reasonable doubt that an officer has committed criminal bias, you better believe I'm going to prosecute somebody. That's the oath that I take as a prosecutor, and it's something I take extremely seriously. But I do think there's a larger question as to what I am doing about the structure of my office. And it's the reason why I say transparency is the best disinfectant, and making sure that we are looking at our practices, policies, and procedures from top to bottom, and making sure that we are going about the work of eliminating bias. Now, I'm not sure an individual audit with a piece of paper and putting that in front of a prosecutor's face and saying you were implicitly biased on these particular things is the way to do it, because I think that if we're really trying to affect justice, we need to take a look at systems, not individual decisions. Mm-hmm. That's certainly my strategy for taking implicit bias extremely seriously.
Two things, if I can reply. One, bias is not a crime. Implicit bias is not a crime.
How
beyond
are you
reasonable doubt. One second, Mr. Merriweather. Implicit bias is not a crime, and beyond reasonable doubt applies to trial. Officers on these videos that we've seen and in interactions with the people, we can see the way folks are treated differently, an aggressive tone towards a black person and a non-aggressive and very polite tone towards a white person suggest something is going on there if no other behavior is different. We need to address that. That's what Mr. Merriweather is not willing to do. Individual accountability in a criminal justice system is the way you address the system. It's not just a system that's operating of and by itself. There are people that are functioning and operating this system, and we have to create awareness across the board. And if a prosecutor, and as many, it's the reason why it's called implicit bias is because we're not always aware of it. Becoming aware of it and then making decisions with that awareness helps us get better. That's what needs to happen. Not just saying it's some thing over here. We got to hold the people who are doing it in a way that makes us better.
Those are words, and what you haven't heard is a plan. I've tried
race
to
for matters, race matters, juvenile to justice,
I've tried
dismantling racism.
Well, I'm gonna,
these programs
I'm
are already here, holding folks accountable. There's a policy that I would put in place.
With
like
the
I just
few minutes that we have left,
it.
I am going to respond to that. We talk about race matters for juvenile justice, and the DA's office is proud to be a leadership partner in that process. But again, you've got to have a plan for how you are going to attack some of these issues. And the whole idea of holding someone accountable, not actually articulating the standard by which you intend to do that, is just words. It's not a plan.
But Mr. Merriweather is conflating the idea of beyond reasonable doubt, which is a trial issue, with prosecutor's decision and discretion. He's not telling you that he can't make a decision after looking at a particular case and then suggesting policies. So what you've heard from him is looking at just the system. What you heard from me is an actual plan and policy to address something as it relates to race. And that's what the difference is between us. That's what needs to happen.
If you give me an opportunity to respond to that, just briefly, proof beyond a reasonable doubt isn't just for trial. It's for the prosecution of crimes. And that is key and critical and central to the responsibility of the district attorney. Mm-hmm. And that's before you walk into the four corners of a courtroom, before you take that to 12 jurors. That's at the center of your responsibility, and someone running for DA ought to know that.
You have Mr. DA, if I can ask you, what statute is implicit bias? What crime do we know? Where is it written in law that implicit bias is a crime?
Exactly.
Where is it written? You don't know, because it's not. A DA should know that. What I'm saying to you is that there are policies we can put in place that help us make decisions. And that's the point here. He's talking about trying to prosecute a crime. I'm talking about decisions to your question, and I'm answering the question you asked as it relates to bias in our system. How are we going to address that? That's a policy decision, not a criminal prosecution decision. His answer is criminal prosecution for a crime that doesn't exist. I'm telling you, it's a bias that we have to address, and policies like holding officers accountable for doing it, making sure the decisions that are in court that relate to bail, relate to bond, and decisions that DAs make with papering are aware of that, and then allowing prosecutors who are making the decisions to become aware of their decisions and what things they're including in that decision-making as it relates to bias.
I want to move on to something else before we end the program, but do you want to respond to that before we do?
Yeah, in order to hold somebody accountable, you got to make sure you have authority with teeth. And just saying you're going to hold somebody accountable, that's great, but it just doesn't, there's no authority behind it.
On the flip side of accountability, one of the things that you have advocated for is helping people who are getting out of prison.
That's right.
Achieve a fresh start. Because you get out of prison with a record, you have very few options, and that sometimes leads you right back to where you started from and it got you into prison in the first place. So how do you give somebody a fresh start?
Well, you know,
how does the DA's office do that?
Well, you were on a stage with myself, Mayor Lyles, Chief Putney, and City Manager Jones, mm-hmm. and I think on that stage, you got a general commitment to making sure that we are marshaling the resources of this county in our jurisdictions behind the idea of providing more resources for returning citizens, ex-offenders. And that's been done in other jurisdictions. It has actually empowered people. It has added to the general economy of the county, putting people to work and putting people in a better position to make positive contributions. That's something, if given 4 years, that I want to put the full power of the district attorney's office behind.
Okay. Toussaint, if elected, want to create an independent police integrity unit to review officer-involved shootings. How is that different from the police review board and whatever any district attorney would do in the case of a shooting?
Civilian review board is something different. That's what the Community Relations Commission or committee has. It has no subpoena power or ability to look into the issues of a particular case. What the police integrity unit is that I was suggesting would deal have a special prosecutor, someone who's not so closely related to the police and the DA's office, someone who is at least one step removed from that. And that special prosecutor could really investigate the case and provide integrity, because it's not just someone looking at the case and making a decision, but someone who the community would trust and say that's someone we believe in that's not biased and that would make and reach a fair conclusion in the case. And I think that's possible to happen. It's happening around the nation again.
Who would be on that unit?
Well, there would be folks vetted. There would be a special prosecutor. There would also be maybe retired judges or other individuals with legal minds who are able to investigate the case and get into it.
Is that a good idea? Do we need that?
I think that any way we can infuse independence into our justice system is great. I think that I, as a district attorney, have a responsibility to do that as well, to make sure that we putting independence in whatever process that we have. It's the reason why I say I don't work for the police, they don't work for me, but I've got a job to make sure that I do independent reviews of whatever comes across my desk.
Okay. We have 30 seconds, 20 seconds for each of you to make a final pitch. You first, Spencer Merriweather.
Fact is that I've brought leadership and experience and a proven ability to make change to this position, and you see what I've done in 5 months. Imagine what we can do in 4 years.
Toussaint Romain?
Yeah, we need more than just talk. We need to actually get some stuff done, and there's not been much actually done other than talk. And so we have issues that folks that are still struggling, and I want to help bring that reform and do it immediately because we can, and our community deserves it. We need public safety as our number one goal.
Former public defender Toussaint Romain running to be the next district attorney. Spencer Merriweather, the current district attorney, who was appointed to fill the role of his predecessor about 5 or 6 months ago. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thanks,
Spencer. For the hour.